This pod was recorded during the 2023 WGA and SAG-AFTRA strikes. Without the labor of the writers and actors currently on strike, the movie being discussed today wouldn't exist.
Let your kid, like, fuck up and get possessed by the devil. Like, you know, yes. Summon Manon.
Like, we saw you on the news. What's going on? I know. You're listening to the Brightwall Darkroom podcast, where we belly up with critics, artists, and our magazine's contributors to speak from the heart about film. I'm Veronica Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Chad Perman.
Chad, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. I'm tired, but I'm always tired.
Me too.
Another month, another pod.
It sounds so terrible.
Let's recut that.
Another month, another pod.
I mean that in an excited way. This is a highlight of the month, though. How are you?
I'm well, yeah. Like, just teaching and talked about Martin and Psycho with my students this morning.
Nice. Good morning.
It is, yeah. Ultimately, it is. I think before it starts, it feels just like hell. But after it's done, it feels great.
Yeah, that's a nice thing about it. It's like exercise.
Yeah. It honestly, sadly, yes. It is like my exact orientation towards something like cardio. Yeah. Just as sweaty.
But I am curious, how many times do you think you've taught Psycho at this point? That's got to come up a lot.
Like a lot. Definitely a lot.
Is it still good after like the 20th time?
I mean, is it still good? Yeah. Psycho still
hits. I've watched it so many times, but I'm just like, I wonder if there's a point at which it just is like, okay, we get it. All right.
Honestly, no. Like there's, if anything, it's almost like a recurrent dream where you remember these like beats of it in a way that feels a lot deeper and more like instinctive than
like
remembering a film really well or something. Yeah. It's almost like driving to a place you've been before and you remember it based on the landmarks or something like that.
Nice.
It's really fabulous. Yeah. But mine is like just the light Psycho treatment. There's like a famous Hitchcock course at Brown that I do not teach. No, but my students are often like really, really well versed in Hitchcock as a result.
Yeah. Nice. And then you throw some Notorious at them at the end or?
Okay. No, that's what I start my intro to film analysis with Notorious.
Oh, yeah. I can't keep it all straight. I just always want to enroll.
Come through.
Yeah, we've got an interesting pick today. I'm excited to see where this conversation goes.
We do.
Yeah.
Let me just introduce our guest so we can get her on mic. Like,
the sooner the better.
Away. So joining us to talk about nostalgia this month is Los Angeles-based film critic Katie Walsh. Katie reviews for the Tribune News Service and the LA Times, in addition to co-hosting the One Heat Minute Productions podcast, Miami Nice, which we are huge fans of here. Her writing has appeared in GQ, Vanity Fair, Rolling Stone, Playboy, all the good places. I love being able to say all those names in a row like this. It is so cool. And she recently introduced Miami Vice to a sold-out screening at LA's American Cinematheque. Today, we have her all to ourselves. Welcome, Katie Walsh.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here to talk about nostalgia and the movie we have on tap and all the good stuff.
Awesome. Yeah, welcome.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's fun to be a guest.
I know. Is it weird being a guest when you're hosting so often?
No, but I'm like, great. You guys get to ask me the questions now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Veronica, you've had similar experiences in the last couple of months.
That's true. I get really nervous guesting.
You've been hosted by Katie.
I know. I've been on Katie's podcast a couple of times and I feel like I'm taking an oral exam when I'm guesting on a podcast. I think, I don't know.
Like, oh, I have to say the right thing.
Yeah, a little bit. I hear myself back and...
Yeah, that's kind of a universal experience, though. Never listen back except for the part where you have to check to make sure you didn't say anything bad.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. And then it's gone down the memory hole.
Exactly.
Down the memory hole. The perfect segue.
And then it comes back years later as a form of nostalgia. Mm-hmm.
Let's go down the memory hole, Chad.
All right. I don't know. Are we ready for that?
Totally ready.
Where do we start in the memory hole?
Okay. Well, we are talking about The Craft this month.
Yes.
Right? which, I mean, how did we really land on this? I feel like part of this is the fact that the three of us are sort of same generation.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Loosely.
The good generation,
which,
I believe.
What did you say?
Old millennials.
Yeah, the good generation.
Yep.
Yeah, so nostalgia has such a like specific meaning for everybody, and it's sort of specifically shared by all of
yeah.
us.
Yeah, but for us, it means the 90s, right?
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
As far as how we got the film, I was just informed that was going to be the film. After some back and forth where we tried to figure out stuff, you're like, Katie's going with the craft. I'm like, okay. Well, there was some nixing of other Robin Tunney projects, but...
That's right. Let's demystify it.
All right. I believe Katie suggested... I don't want to get it wrong. I wasn't involved in the conversation. But I believe Katie suggested Empire Records, and...
That's right.
Veronica was like, I don't know.
Well, it was interesting when you guys suggested nostalgia to me, because I went a couple different ways. I was like, one, I could go with a movie or a movie that represents an era that I'm nostalgic for, which is the mid-90s. So immediately I started thinking of movies like Empire Records, which isn't a very good movie, but totally encompasses everything that I'm nostalgic for from that era. And I just watched it mm-hmm. so many times growing up and yes. just thought that like life would be like that when I was in my early 20s. Guess what? It was not. Yeah. And then when you watch it in your 30s, you're like, fuck these kids. Like, you just start identifying with the Anthony LaPaglia character so much or something. Like, I'm just like, oh, brother, they're doing yeah. arts and crafts and getting high. And it's just funny. But I'm not about this movie. This podcast is not about Empire Records. But
no.
Then I also thought about the way filmmakers use nostalgia as a weapon or to make cultural commentary, mm-hmm. which made me think of They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Which is, I think, mm-hmm. a movie where Sidney Pollack like weaponizes nostalgia for the 1930s into this like really searing mm-hmm. commentary of the entire culture that we live in.
Yes.
We also talked about The Big Chill. I'm a huge hater of The Big Chill.
Yes, I remember. Like... I had to nix that one. One, because this is my obligatory mention of my mom in the podcast. It's one of her favorite movies.
Ding!
All right, check that off. And then two, we have an actually really wonderful essay that does also, it's not a huge fan of the movie, but I just didn't want it to look like we were crapping on something that we'd run something on.
We don't have to go too hard on The Big Chill.
But the whiplash between They Shoot Horses, Don't They, and Empire Records is my two choices. I'm like, I have never gotten an email like that in my life. So.
These are your choices, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, so then The Big Chill, I was like, well, I can like roast this movie for you, but I guess we decided to go in a different direction. But yeah, I think The Craft is just, and then Veronica suggested The Craft, and I think that it's just like a just representative of this era of when we were a certain age and, you know, very impressionable young teens and tweens. And it's also just like a very weird movie. It's like not that good, but also great. So I think it's kind of a perfect choice. And I think it's good to go with the one that you have warm, fuzzy feelings about.
Definitely, yeah.
Or at least I do.
I like that angle of nostalgia. Yeah.
I totally do, too. Yeah. I was just thinking, like, what is like Empire Records but isn't Empire Records? And wondering, like, how much more of that category we could fill out. And now that you've said what you've said about it, I'm really curious if you feel similarly about Reality Bites in terms of, like, your identification shifting to the kind of, like, cranky older figure as opposed to being like in the Winona Ryder camp?
Yeah, I think I was a little bit older when I saw Reality Bites, so I wasn't looking like, wow, they're so cool. Although, you know, you do have that experience. But yeah, when you watch Reality Bites as an older person, you're just like, oh, this guy sucks so bad. Like, he's not hot. He's toxic. Like, get away from him. Yeah. Date Ben Stiller.
It set a lot of templates for a lot of people in life, unfortunately.
Yeah,
totally. But I also had read Katie's review of the new Craft, the Craft : Legacy.
I did not know that existed until you told me you'd read her review.
Oh, really?
It was the pandemic. It was not what happened in 2020. I don't remember anything from that year.
I think I've been a little bit attentive to Zoe Lister-Jones's career. And so I was interested. And, you know, I love The Craft, the original Craft. So I was like really curious what they would do with it. And I want to put a pin in it so we can talk about this like later in the episode. I would love to hear you, Katie, do a little bit of a comparative analysis of these two films. If you even remember, usually after I write about something, it leaves my brain like clearing the cache on Google. But
well, you had sent the link to my review and I was like, oh, yeah, that movie. And then I was reading the review and I was like, completely forgot about that part of it. The whole David Duchovny, like toxic masculinity cults.
Wait, he's in it?
Yes.
He's in it.
Yeah. Part of it. And I was like, I don't remember that at all. But I also feel like any review of any movie I wrote in the depths of 2020 like needs to have a little like asterisk next to it. Like,
okay, that's
fair. Think I was just like, oh my God, great. Sure, it's a movie. thumbs up. Like, I was just in a weird place, especially the fall of 2020. I was not in my right mind. But because you said I was a little like nice to it.
You were. It's a very generous review, I thought, in a good way.
It was generous, but I think I just was like, cool, I'm watching a movie.
We were generous towards lots of things. We're so excited anything existed that wasn't the exact same thing that we did the day before.
I know.
Right.
It's good.
And I think this is the latest ever that we've gotten to the synopsis.
That's true. That's true.
We should do the synopsis and then rejoin.
Okay, let's do it. So for the uninitiated, who I just hope nobody is that at this point in the episode.
Well, they've already turned up. They turned it off when they heard the title.
The Craft. It's Andrew Fleming, so director of Dick, for those who need to make that connection. His contribution to the mid-90s teen witch moment, which I'm sure anyone can imagine was a really big part of my own life.
I could imagine that.
Wherein we had ABC's Sabrina the Teenage Witch series, adaptation of the Archie comic back in 96. And then we had Buffy in 97 and Charmed in 98, kind of completing the triumvirate. So when Sarah Bailey, played by Robin Tunney, moves in with her dad and stepmom to L.A., she falls in with three aspiring witches on the social outskirts of her new school. Each has something that she wants to change about her life, whether it's taking revenge on a racist bully or resisting a creepy stepdad, or in Bonnie's case, healing literal scars for the chance to feel beautiful. So The Craft takes a kind of supernatural route to discover why girls long for power and what happens when they get it. Katie, I would love to know, like, when did you first see this film?
You know, it came out in 96, so I would have been 13. I don't think I saw it in theaters. It would have been very unlikely if I saw it in theaters because I grew up in the Virgin Islands, and I am doubtful that it came to the movie theater there. Although I did watch like every mid-90s horror movie in the theater on my home island of St. Croix.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
I probably saw it like a Blockbuster rental. I don't have a solid memory of like the first time I watched it, but I was really into like Rocky Horror Picture Show at that time and like kind of dabbling in horror and starting to become a little bit of a cinephile or paying attention to movies. But I was like not like a cool cinephile. I was just like, I'm obsessed with Batman Forever.
Yeah.
Like I was just starting to pay attention to like mainstream stuff that was coming out. It's funny because you sent the oral history that they the first thing they did was put the girls in these kind of gothy schoolgirl outfits and then like send them down a hall in slow-mo. Yeah,
Portishead.
Yeah. Right.
And walking in that iconic, you know, four abreast, pun intended, vibe, which like, you know, Jawbreaker does it. Like every teen girl movie does the look.
Yes.
Now, and when I was in college at Wesleyan, I made a horror film for my senior thesis. And I was like, got to do the hallway walk. We're doing the hallway walk, guys.
Stop.
So I think I only wanted to make a movie just to do that. And then had literally empty headed for the rest of it. Like I was like, what? This movie needs dialogue. Yeah. Well, that's why I'm not a filmmaker, guys.
But, let's get him back in the hall.
Yeah. Just as many slow-mo hallway shots as possible. But this movie is impressionistic in the sense that it just leaves very specific images and tones and vibes in your memory and just impacts you like that, in the sense that it's like you don't remember what the story is, but you remember Firouza Balk and you remember them on the beach, you know, calling the corners, and you remember these really iconic moments and these iconic outfits, and like the rest of it doesn't really matter. But so I think it just was one of those like tween wannabe edgy kind of moments for me watching it.
It sounds really impactful if you like ended up making this thesis. I also love that you're describing your burgeoning cinephilia as being quote unquote not cool. Sounds pretty cool, but that you were like getting into mainstream film and now you're this like really like central proponent of mainstream cinematic genres. I think that is so cool.
It's funny because people will be like, oh, you're a film critic, like you must be a snob, and I'm like, no, I give positive reviews to Michael Bay movies, so that's who I am.
Totally. The Lord's work.
I love the high-low of it all. I'm a populist film critic.
Love that.
Yes.
Love that. Love that. Chad, had you seen the movie before?
Yeah, I had seen it not quite as many times as Empire Records, but certainly plenty of times because I mentioned to Veronica a couple weeks ago, my younger sister, whose name is also Katie, she only had maybe three movies total, like VHS movies, and they would be on a lot. So there was a lot of Newsies, and there was a lot of Empire Records, and there was a lot of The Craft.
Iconic lineup.
Yeah, Newsies was young. I mean, if it's one of these things, it's not like the other.
The Craft.
I mean, it was as she was moving from, you know, junior high to high school. To
all about belonging.
Those are the only three movies you need.
Yes. They call, a lot of people refer to it as the trilogy.
I'd be fine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Send those to space.
Now, Empire Records, I've seen, I mean, I feel like I could probably still quote the whole thing from memory because that was her number one movie. So that was always on. Anytime it was her turn, we had turns for who could watch the TV. This is, I'm making this sound like dinosaurs. Yes. There was not screens throughout the house. There was a screen and we had to share it.
Yeah.
I was burgeoning in my cinephilia as well. So I was trying to, like, you know, get all these movies from the library and just get a different thing, try to watch a movie a day. And she was like, okay, it's my turn, Empire Records. So, yeah. So The Craft was probably the one that I was able to ignore the most when it was on, just because I just felt like, okay, I get it. And then it was good the first time. But then I hadn't revisited it at all. And I've still not seen Newsies back since back then either. So maybe we can do that next time. Yeah, Newsies pod.
For your labor unions month.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
Hey, good.
Upcoming.
Yeah, in solidarity.
What did you think of it?
It was an okay film watching it again this time. I mean, I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it. It was just okay. But what I was really just continually overwhelmed by was like that the 90s now has a feel to it. I guess I just hadn't watched it. I mean, the way that the 80s had that, like, you know, the synth score comes on and all this, you know, the color schemes and all that kind of stuff. You're like, oh, it's an 80s movie for, you know, a good number of them. As soon as, can't even say this without laughing, and it's not funny to three-fourths of the listeners because they won't even know what I'm talking about. But as soon as Our Lady Peace's cover of a Beatles song starts the film, I'm just laughing. I was like, oh, this is what people think of, like, when my kids think of the 90s, they think of, not hopefully not Our Lady Peace, but they think of that entire soundtrack. And so I just kept being hit with, like, this feels so 90s, and I never... Maybe I haven't revisited a lot of the films from the mid-90s that elicit those feelings, but I just was like, oh, yeah, I'm getting just older and older. So, I mean, I tried to make it about me.
Naturally. Yeah.
But no, I mean, I thought there was lots of good, and I should say I had a huge crush on Robin Tunney, and I had a huge crush on Fairuza Balk.
Wait, she didn't scare you?
Oh, yeah, but that was the appeal. I mean, I was in high school, and that was the kind of girls that I was dating, and I was like, I can understand them better if I just get to know this character. Yeah, no, that was a definite type for me at one point in my life. So at the time, I liked Neve Campbell a lot. Now I see her through the lens of all the other things that she's been in and done, and I just have a different version of her, but my vision of Fairuza and Robin remained very similar to what it was when I saw it in the 90s. So.
Frozen in time.
Yeah.
Totally.
And also just noticing, oh yeah, that means I must have seen two movies with Neve Campbell and Skeet Ulrich in it in the same year of my life in a movie theater.
Right.
Yeah. Dream. I just was like, wait, he's in this? I totally memory hold him. He was gone. But I was like, oh, hey.
Yeah.
And then I was trying to figure out if Breckenmeyer had been in Scream for like way too long when the internet exists. And I could have just looked it up, but he was not.
No.
I rewatched this movie in 2020 when the new one came out. Then I watched it again last year at a rep screening. I've been watching The Craft a lot these past couple years. Rewatching it this time, I was like, oh, Breckenmeyer, was he in Scream? Because he feels
exactly.
like someone that would be in Scream.
He feels
but
like he'd be in
he's
it.
Not.
I think it's the Jamie Kennedy character is the confusion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
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 And then which one was in Can't Hardly Wait? I mean, I'm just, the questions spiral.
Yeah. That's Seth Green, isn't it?
I don't know. They're all the same person.
Someone has to be like a jester who's like 5'7" or something in all of these.
They couldn't all be in the same movie at once. Like, it wouldn't be allowed.
If only.
And they could be in Multiplicity.
If only.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now, Veronica, let me ask you.
Yeah. Well, for me, this movie is like SNL's Stefan voice. This movie has everything. Like, goth. Schoolgirl. Like, I, of course, was like wearing a rosary around my neck in like high school, thinking I had powers. I mean, it's like witchcraft for like the Delia's catalog generation.
Yes.
Like,
but weren't you also in like the drama or theater stuff too? Or
yeah. What do you mean? Also, I mean, these are overlapping. Like the Venn diagram is a complete circle.
It's different on the West Coast. Totally. The goth people were way different than the theater people at my high school.
No. Well, we were all in the arts building, the Spring Bank Arts Building at West Potomac High School. So yeah, go straight from AP art over to theater practice in my like black eyeliner. Totally. I just thought like, something that the 90s, I think, represented that I do think we don't have anymore and I do feel nostalgia for is subculture. Yeah. Like, I just don't really think that we have subculture anymore post-internet. And the way that, like, really everything after Tumblr, I want to say, made certain aesthetics, like, totally pervasive and expansively accessible to everyone. And you no longer have those kinds of, I mean, and I'm not saying these are all great. Like the way that they're sent up in a lot of 90s movies, like Clueless is hilarious and accurate, how we have these like different sort of subsets of people socially who only hang out with each other. And that kind of like social segregation is not the coolest thing in the world. But the sense of like finding other things to be into that would then unlock like different hangouts, different style.
Yeah, that doesn't exist
different
anymore.
Like love interests and also kind of a different set of like values and maybe politics and ethics in addition to sort of aesthetics.
There is a shorthand.
Yeah, I miss that. Yeah. Like I think there's a weirdness that's a little alienating that maybe I'm just like, you know, doing that thing where you, I'm saying it to Chad, like you, a therapist would know.
Kids these days. Oh.
No, like a, like it's okay. I was bullied or something, you know, like it made me stronger.
There's a, I mean, at least in my recollections of all that, there was an empowerment to finding your tribe and finding like kind of the subculture and being like, oh, okay. So, I mean, I was one of those people that was like, the sports guy in like seventh grade. And then I was very much not the sports guy, but then you have to find a new place and finding people through specifically. And, you know, obviously I probably still do this as an adult looking for friends, finding it through people that share similar movie tastes or musical tastes as a starting point. You know, I was like, you know, I might not be able to walk up and introduce myself to someone casually or randomly, but I can certainly strike up a conversation or participate in one about movies or music, or whatever. But in order to do that, you had to have seen these things and they weren't always easy to see. You couldn't I had to go to used record stores to find like, you know, vinyl copies of records that people were talking about from the 70s. It just, I know how old this all sounds, but it's just like, I think something huge is lost in, I mean, the specific memory of waiting for these songs from probably some that are on the soundtrack to come on the radio and you'd have to wait for a couple hours to record, to record it. And then every mixtape you have has like little clips of DJs or radio stuff over.
Right.
You know, that whole thing about what is it? There's a famous quote that I'm going to butcher. Maybe we can edit it in later. But that attention is a form of love. You know, the more time and effort that you're putting into chasing these things down, if they suck, it's really, really disappointing. But for the most part, it made up my whole life. So in that way, watching The Craft was an enjoyable experience, even if I was like, oh, yeah, I'm much more critical as a person watching movies now. But the feeling of it was still great, and I really enjoyed watching it because of that feeling.
There was so much work you had to do to be in a subculture or to educate yourself about music or movies, whatever it was. You had to, I mean, I would visit my grandparents and buy a bunch of CDs and be like, half of these suck. And then I would read all the liner notes and like go on the dial-up computer and like, you know, when you go to their website and it's loading slowly down the screen, like, you know, and it's like that quote at the end of Worst Person in the World where Anders Danielson Lee is talking about the tangibility of physical media and what you lose without record stores and owning something and holding a piece of art that you love. And the amount of sort of like loving labor that you would put into educating yourself. And I think you kind of get that in this movie when they go to the witch store.
The witch store.
Yeah.
There, you know, against all odds, there was one of these like metaphysical bookshops where I grew up, and the amount of like,
wow,
all those shops are so specific.
I know they're so specific, and I love, they're like so comforting to me. There's one here in LA that I just love so much. Like, my friend was literally texting me today. She's like, "What's your witch store? I need one that's dusty." I was like, "I got you, girl."
the amount of...
It's gotta be dust. Are there non-dusty witch stars?
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's like this chain out here called House of Intuition that's like a little...
Chain witch stars?
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, like the amount of freaking Nag Champa incense I bought and like tarot cards that I did not know how to read and all this bullshit at these stores that I would buy. And it's exactly represented by that store that they go to. And they were putting in the work. They were reading those books.
They were stealing them. They were reading them.
They weren't looking on Wikipedia. Yeah.
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 Every month on Bright Wall Dark Room, we belly up with critics, artists, and contributors to speak from the heart about film, which got us thinking, what if we had a space like that every day of the week? A space where artists can go off script on love for their craft.
Introducing Gallery, a new cinema club built by today's most celebrated filmmakers. Helmed by Indian Paintbrush, the folks who brought you the Grand Budapest Hotel and the upcoming Asteroid City, Gallery combines personal film collections, thoughtful essays, and live experiences into a single destination. Built by artists as a response and alternative to binge culture, Gallery is not a streaming service. It's all human, no algorithm. A communal cinema experience that celebrates the nuances so often missing in today's industry. And Bright Wall Dark Room listeners are invited to receive early access before its official public launch.
Gallery is shaped by many filmmakers that we love here at Bright Wall Dark Room, including Mike Mills, Karen Kusama, Ed Lachman, Taylor Russell, Ethan Hawke, and Maggie Gyllenhaal. Members will enjoy access to these artists' hand-picked film libraries, as well as original videos, audio stories, in-depth articles, and exclusive live events. Because, like Bright Wall Dark Room, Gallery is a community that believes movies are better experienced together.
To join the club, go to www.join.gallery.com/BWDR. That's GALERIE.com/BWDR. Something I love about this movie is how few, I mean, I know we have the kind of like iconic, gorgeous witch store attendant in the film who does play a sort of pivotal role toward the end. But for the most part, there's like no adults in the movie. And it's something I totally love about like a teenage film or a coming of age film when young people are just allowed to or find ways to make their own fun slash trouble outside of the supervision of adults. Yeah. And it makes the cruelty in the film of how people treat each other really harrowing, I think, because there's no intervention. But it also makes the sort of moments of community and friendship that do emerge before everything goes to shit really, really moving. And in both ways, it's sort of like more deep than I would expect a film like this to be, given the sort of like silliness of its premise.
I think it's representative of like boomer parents raising... Gen X or older millennial kids, because my sister is a Gen X parent raising Zoomer kids and they're like best friends and hang out all the time. And I'm like, leave them alone. Like,
right. Right.
By the way, don't listen to this, my older sister, but I'm like,
we'll call you Katie W.
You don't have to be best friends with your daughter. Like, she's like, oh, the gossip, I know. And they're like partying together. I'm like, lame, let your kid like fuck up and summon Manon and, you know, get possessed by the devil, like,
and sleep on the beach all night. No one knows where you are. Like,
kill all the sharks.
Are you
the
good?
Sharks are all dead, but we don't apparently need to check in on that.
Like, we saw you on the news. What's going on?
But and also the one, the person they had as the dad, I mean, this is only going to be specific to me, but he was also the dad playing the very similar role 10 years before in Flight of the Navigator, which was like my slumber party movie as a kid.
Okay.
And then I looked him up on Wikipedia because the internet now does exist. He, this is just for my amusement only, maybe, he was the lead singer in a psychedelic rock band that like influenced all these people in the 60s and 70s. Just not the vibe he gives off in anything he's ever in. He's always this kind of well-meaning, bumbling dad. He's like, would, I think, protect the Robin Tunney character, but just doesn't know what to do. And then all of a sudden, he's weighing over his head.
Yeah.
That's really the only, I mean, I always just say the actors' names. I don't know the characters' names, I'm realizing. So Firouza Balk's like, you know, mom's in it for a little bit, and obviously his stepdad's in it, stuff like that. But yeah, they're very peripheral and really only to... Yeah. To move the plot forward in some way. So the Charlie Brown effect, but with teenagers.
Right. I think of a lot of witch stories, maybe because of the Salem connection, as usually having this like really East Coast Victorian type of vibe.
Which ones are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of Practical Magic.
Hocus Pocus.
Right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Hocus Pocus. Yeah, I was going
to
say.
Yeah. But this is, to me, and I've never lived in L.A., but have like just as a viewer of the film, such an L.A. movie. Mm-hmm. And Katie as our like resident L.A. resident. What do you think?
Okay. The funniest thing to me about this movie is that when they arrive in L.A., it's pouring rain.
I know.
You know, obviously things have changed here climate wise a bit, but I'm like, it never rains in L.A.
Yeah.
So it's just very funny that like they arrive at LAX. It's pouring rain. They get to the house. It's pouring. I'm like, this is a very weird way to introduce L.A. Watching it this time, I was like, maybe that's on purpose. Like maybe they're trying to do something totally different. That's not the usual. Like they're trying to be like, this is different. It's not, you know, palm trees and long boulevards and people surfing and stuff when they introduce us. And then other than that, though, it's like weird that it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of weird that it's in LA because I don't feel like the city is really a character in the movie.
Yeah, not really at all.
I mean, obviously there's like some locations where I'm like, oh, that's that or that, like, you know, when they go downtown and they run into the guy and the creepy homeless guy with the snake and stuff. And
oh, yeah. Creepy snake
and,
guy.
And so you're like, oh, that's downtown. But even then you're like, why would they be hanging out downtown? And, you know, it does the thing where they like cut locations together. It's not a Michael Mann movie. It's like they're like on Melrose and then they're in downtown.
Wait.
And you're like, wait. The geography is not working out here. Just, you know, and we just talked about Collateral on my podcast and how the geography is so perfect. And Michael Mann really takes care to be like, it takes this long to get from here to here when he's making an LA movie. But this one is just like all over the place.
Magic carpet ride.
Yeah. I would not categorize this as an LA movie, but it is it is funny that it is set here and the way they kind of treat it as a setting and in not a way that you would expect.
Yeah. I like that it's a little scuzzy, like in those moments when they're traipsing around in like downtown. Though I think one of the times I saw it, I was like, is that Hollywood? It just feels like it's creepy and they shouldn't be there. They should be at home.
Yeah.
Like, well, I think what time is it?
Yeah, I think the witch store, at one point, do they say Melrose? I feel like they say that they're going to go shopping on Melrose or something.
Yes. And yeah, from after school.
Yeah.
And they're walking there, right?
Right.
So they take the bus to like the woods to do a spell.
Drop me off at the woods.
And then they go to the beach, but it's not clear if it's Venice or Malibu. Yeah.
I know.
It's just sort of like.
Which one has the most sharks in the world? That's a lot of sharks to be in one little area of an ocean.
Yeah. It is.
So it's not, you know, like representative of the city.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you guys too, because I have far less insight on the dynamics. How do you feel it captures, you know, female friendships and process, like, you know, four teenage girls trying to navigate relationships together and all the different possible combinations and alliance? Anyway, how did you think it handled that? Was it accurate? How did you think it handled that?
I think what it gets is the competitiveness between Sarah, who, like, I always forget her name. I'm like, Robin Tunney.
Yeah,
but Sarah and Nancy Furzbalk. You just instantly clock that Nancy's like, who the hell is this bitch? And why does she know how to do this better than I do? And I just think that kind of weird competitiveness comes through. That competitiveness between teenage girls, I think, is actually true. And not even teenage girls, just women in general.
Yeah, I do think that the idea of a coven is like a perfect form for thinking about how women who have similar interests like relate to each other. Because in this scenario, like there does feel like there's a competitiveness between them, but also like a pressure from outside. Like there just doesn't seem like there is space for all of them to be powerful or happy. And I mean, we see this happening not just with like the witchcraft powers and the fact that Sarah's a quote unquote natural witch who's inherited her power from her mother, but also also that Nancy, you know, is jealous because her family sucks.
Yeah.
And Sarah has a father who clearly like cares about her. And even though her mother is dead. She's like given her these powers that Nancy's really jealous of. And it becomes clear, of course, that Nancy was involved with the same like horrible guy that Sarah gets involved with the second that she arrives on campus. So it's almost like this competitiveness in the movie, as in life, comes from a sense of like resource scarcity, as opposed to just women on women not liking each other, or like women being inherently like mean spirited or something.
Yeah, because I think Nancy is inherently overcompensating for her lack of financial resources or precarity, you know, safety that she is experiencing. Like, she is trying to be super scary, super powerful, super intimidating. Like, you guys can't say shit to me because I am intimidating to you in the like high school ecosystem. And maybe that comes from trauma with Chris, and maybe it comes from her insecurities of her background. But I also think, because I also like, I just being a woman in the world, but also I watch the Real Housewives franchise. I think anytime you get more than two women in a group, if you get three or more, there's going to be shit talking happening. There's going to be two saying, God, what's up with her?
Do you mean shit talking like off over in the side, like behind the like person's back?
Alliances. Yeah.
There's going to be the two that say like, God, she's being a bitch today or whatever. I mean, I'm a girl's girl. I have lots of female friendships. I have two sisters. I understand the woman's mind in terms of social dynamics. And unfortunately, it will happen. And sometimes it's necessary to complain about your friend. But yeah, it's just a hazard of the dynamic.
Well, and most people in the therapy world anyway will say that like the most difficult client, the most difficult people like to work with in general are teenage girls, not because of anything inherent to an individual teenage girl, but because it is so hard to keep track of the different alliances that shift like every week and the friendship groups that are usually what they're wanting to talk about the most. And this kind of like half joking, but probably not really a joke thing. Like if a female, especially a teenage female, is having a problem with another teenage female. Sorry, I'm an AI.
We don't say females.
None of us were talking about like specimens.
When a teenage
female.
I know.
Yes.
We'll have ChatGPT rewrite this part.
ChatGPT, yes. I get the puns in for Eli. Yeah, but what they'll say is that teenage girls, if they're having a problem with somebody, they will, you know, construct this whole elaborate Machiavellian plot to take that person down. Whereas if two guys that are at the same age have a problem with each other, one walks up and punches the other one in the face, you know. So it's just a lot easier to understand, like, oh, this is, you know, the dynamics there are, oh, I was mad at this guy, so I hit him, and now we're good. We're bros again. And with women, it's like this huge, like, multi-session thing about...
It's a little more Baroque with women,
It's elaborate. The plots and the...
Yes.
You know, and so here in the craft, is you can see that whole thing kind of happen as they're... We haven't even said the word glamour yet. How do we get this far into the podcast without saying... that was just a glamour.
The reason why women craft elaborate plots is because they are what? Smarter than men.
Much more so. Well, you have to be emotionally intelligent to be able to come up with that stuff.
And emotionally devious as well.
Emotionally, Well, you have to know how to do it to be able to do it,
Right.
I love that this movie like depicts that without patting itself on the back for doing that. You know, it's something that like if you just watch the movie, you get a sense of it. It has this very straightforward kind of readable take on how young women are with each other and how the world sort of pushes them into corners without of like the announcing itself that way, you know. Pushing us in the four corners.
I also just like the chanting, which I know we haven't talked much about. I wanted to put that out there.
We haven't talked about the chanting.
I like, you know, I like a little OCD, like the repetitiveness of it. It's nice.
Well, I love chanting, actually, as a person of yoga teacher experience. I love to chant.
It is centering.
I am from LA, guys, or live in LA. In fact, in order to prove my bona fides, I have Rachel True's tarot deck.
Ooh.
Stop it.
Which I just remembered and pulled out of my drawer.
True Heart Intuitive Tarot. Wow.
Is she the one that's in the movie?
Yes, she plays Rochelle.
Yes.
She released a tarot book?
Yes, she has a guidebook that's like sort of a memoir slash tarot book. And then actually the deck is really beautiful, beautifully illustrated. So highly recommend getting the True Heart.
They look beautiful to everyone. She's showing us the cards. I said this is a podcast, but yes.
I know Veronica wants to see them.
I really do. My mind is blown that you just busted out this totally on theme prop.
I know. I was like, oh, wait, I have Rachel True's tarot deck.
And you had this already?
Yes. I bought it like a couple years ago.
As soon as you picked a craft, she Googled it.
So funny.
Let's pick a card for our...
Yes, let's pick a card on Mike. Yes.
To see what's going to happen for the rest of the podcast. All right, we're picking a card. I'm going to pick this one.
Prepare to take a
screenshot. Ooh, it's the Four of Cups.
Tell us about it.
The Cups refers to emotions. Also, four girlies. Just to say.
Four corners.
Yeah. Like us four girlies right now. It's amazing. It's
four corners, four girlies, four cups. Yeah, so it refers to emotions. In this image, a guy is pouring one of the cups out, and there's a little rose, and there's also like a creepy eye.
Ooh, the eye.
Oh, my God.
I think this card means that we're discovering something new in a place where we didn't expect it. That's what
beautiful.
I'm going to say.
Yeah. Can you come on and pull a card every episode?
Yes.
Yeah, we can have Katie's Tarot Corner.
I do read tarot, but I'm better at reading the traditional Rider-Waite deck than this one because I...
Than the Rachel True deck.
Than the Rachel True deck, yeah.
The True Heart deck?
I will learn it.
Shout out. We need to get a coupon code for that.
Yeah.
Yes. Man,
I think we just sold at least 10 copies probably.
I know.
Yeah. How recently was that she put that out?
I don't know if it's on here, but definitely in the last couple of years.
Okay.
She's actually friends of a friend of mine, and sometimes he brings her to screening. So I have met her.
Oh, cool. Very cool.
Wow.
Yeah, she's still around. Oh, 2020. So
we were all doing weird things in 2020.
Yeah. Probably time to the new movie coming out.
Oh, Legacy. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when all the tween Zoomer girls were watching them do like their fairy rituals, she's like, guys, I have something that's going to be good for this.
The tie-in.
Yeah.
So enterprising.
And then just a couple of years later, I had the Blair Witch Project to end the witch.
I know. Decade. Not exactly the same vibe, though.
No. Different vibe. Not even remotely. Yeah.
Different vibe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't go see that one in the theater. I was like, that's going to freak me out too much. But I had no problem going to see The Craft.
A surprising R rating on The Craft.
It
is R rated because of like devil worshiping.
Oh, yeah. That was a much bigger thing back then. I mean, the fear around devil worshiping.
Satanic panic. Yeah.
Ouija boards were like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it is a pretty like surprisingly edgy film. Dark. I mean, when I was rewatching it, the scene where, who is it? It's Ben Stiller's wife. It is.
Oh, Christine Taylor.
Christine Taylor.
Christine Taylor. Sorry, Christine Taylor. When Laura Lizzie is losing her hair in the communal gym shower.
That is freaky.
That's freaky.
Like, it's freaky. And I just love the practical effects. I just think they look so much strangely more expensive and like believable. And it's so much scarier.
Well, awesome. Tangible,
all the
too.
Animals at the end are real.
I know. Can you imagine? I would have lost my mind. I'm losing
all
my mind watching it.
All those snakes and all those bugs are real.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was like the most snakes ever used in a movie.
Most snakes.
I think Raiders of the Lost Ark has got to beat that.
She's
right?
The girl with the most snakes. It's just totally so scary.
Why was there no like hole music in there or something?
Title of Ebb.
Yeah, hole would have been really good.
And a couple years later, the whole thing would have been like an Evanescence soundtrack. So that would have
sucked. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do love the soundtrack, like, because it's all covers.
Yeah.
It's like the Smiths cover, which I think was the first time I ever heard that song.
Mm.
Letters to Cleo does a cover.
They were required to be in several 90s movies.
You had to have Letters to Cleo. Yeah. Yeah, great soundtrack.
It's a good soundtrack, yeah.
Yeah.
But again, hearing it for the first time in 20, 30 years,
you said,
I was like, oh my God, like I'm in the 90s, you know? And then specifically you can track to which part of the 90s you were at, because if it was late 90s, it would have like, Harvey Danger on it or whatever. So
yeah, or yeah. Limp Bizkit or something.
Yeah. Oh, that's what it, that's when music really just I stopped. Yeah.
Last call. So we end every episode asking our guests to share a kind of staff recommendation, which I had to explain in an episode a few back. Was like when you go to a video store, I feel so ridiculous saying this, but like when you go to a video store and there's like a little index card or something that's like Katie recommends. So it could be anything from any time. Katie, what would you recommend to our listeners?
Well, first of all, I just wanted to shout out, this isn't really a recommendation that can apply to a lot of people. I have another one. I'm sorry. I'm going to do this very quickly.
No, do it. Do it. That's great.
I just saw a play in LA that also played in New York. It's called Our Dear Dead Drug Lord. Mm. And it's about four girls who are obsessed with Pablo Escobar. And they do a seance to bring the spirit of Pablo Escobar back to life. And I was watching it with this movie in mind and just going, the teenage girls are still at it. They are doing seances. They're in schoolgirl outfits. They are, and it is just very representative of this kind of foursome of teen girls getting up to no good.
Love that.
If that play like happens to be playing near you, or just seek it out in some way, I feel like it's going to have a longer future.
Awesome.
And then my actual recommendation is the movie Rotting in the Sun, which is going to be on Mubi September 15th. So it's already on Mubi. It is a Sebastian Silva film. I love this filmmaker. He's a Chilean filmmaker. This is a wacky piece of autofiction and like genre play where he is playing himself, a very depressed version of himself. And he goes to a nude beach in Mexico and meets an influencer, Jordan Firstman, who's also playing a version of himself. And it turns into this missing person mystery all about Sebastian going missing and Jordan trying to find him. It's got real Safdie Brothers energy. It's like gay uncut gems. It's so good. It's outrageous and hilarious. And there are a lot of dick and balls in this movie. So I just want everyone to know that. So that's either a draw or a trigger warning, but just so you know, that's what's in the movie.
Amazing. Amazing. Oh my God. What a great, that's a great rec. And I can just imagine the index card now.
You know? Yeah.
Well worn. Yeah.
Thank you.
CW colon. Yeah.
Yeah.
Katie, thank you so much for joining us. Such a pleasure having you.
Oh, thank you so much. There's so much more I could say about this movie, but I think we covered a lot of the main points. So thank you for having me.
Totally. Katie, where can we find you online?
I am on Twitter and Letterboxd at Katie Walsh STX. All my stuff is on Rotten Tomatoes, but I link all my reviews on my Twitter, on my Letterboxd. And if you just search Katie Walsh on Rotten Tomatoes, you can find all my reviews. I am fairly easy to find, even though Kate Walsh from Grey's Anatomy messes up my SEO. That's fine.
What does the STX stand for?
STX stands for St. Croix. It's where I'm from.
Okay.
It is the airport code for St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands, which is where I grew up. So
rad.
It is not Katie Walsh's Texas, which some people think that it is.
Oh my God. I love knowing that.
Yeah.
Well, Katie Walsh's Texas, so great to have you.
Thank you for having me. This was a pleasure.
It was very nice to meet you, and I hope that we get stuck in sometime soon.
Yeah, thank you. It's nice to meet you, too. Yeah, for sure. Thank you for having me.
To read this month's issue, visit us at brightwalldarkroom.com. You can also find us on Twitter at BWDR and at the BWDR podcast. This episode is sponsored by Gallery, a new kind of film club. Listeners can sign up at join.gallery.com/BWDR. And this month, I'm hosting a live chat discussion of Jonathan Glazer's Birth on Wednesday, September 20th. Follow us and join Gallery for more information.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, please share it with a few friends or give us a rating or review. The way the algorithms work on this series of tubes we call the internet, nothing really helps us be seen and heard by a wider audience more than getting those R&Rs. So if you have a few seconds, smash the stars on your phone right now and help support the show.
Our theme music is composed by Chad Perman. This podcast is produced and edited by Eli Sands.
Bye!
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm hearing construction noises.
Sorry. It's
you. Okay.
It's me. It's my construction workers.
I thought it was maybe me. So, okay. Anyway.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah.
She's a part-time construction manager. So.
Yeah. The guys will be done any minute.
Oh, okay. Put it down over there.